This morning, I'd like you to take your Bibles, if you have them, and turn to Hebrews, the fourth chapter. Hebrews chapter 4, and we'll read the first three verses of this particular chapter. Hebrews 4, beginning with verse 1, it says, "Let us therefore fear, lest a promise being left us of entering into his rest, any of you should seem to come short of it. For unto us was the gospel preached, as well as unto them, but the word preached did not profit them, not being mixed with faith in them that heard it. For we which have believed do enter into rest, as he said, As I have sworn in my wrath, if they shall enter into my rest, although the works were finished from the foundations of the world." Now, I want to concentrate in this particular message on verse 1, particularly the phrase, "Let us therefore fear, lest any of you should come short of it," that is, the promise of God as found in His Word, and particularly the Gospel in this particular instance as found there in this particular passage. However, before actually concentrating on that particular phrase, or at least elaborating and addressing what's stated in that particular phrase of verse 1 of Hebrews 4, before doing so, let me share with you what inspired me to preach to this particular message. A couple of weeks ago, my family and I were blessed to attend the Bluegrass Gospel Festival Sunday morning service in Elizabeth, Colorado. And we were privileged to hear a very good sermon, at least as far as it went. It was a message about Naaman the leper, as found in 2 Kings chapter 5. And in fact, let's turn there and look at this story for those who may not be all that familiar with this story as found in this passage. 2 Kings chapter 5 is where we want to go. Kind of look at this and take this story apart a verse at a time. 2 Kings, we'll start with chapter 5, or in chapter 5, we'll begin with verse 1. And there we find this. It says, "And Hiram, king of Tyre, sent his servant unto Solomon." Wait a minute, that's 1 Kings. Give some of you the chance to get there while I get there. 2 Kings, chapter 5, verse 1. It says, "And now Naaman, captain of the host of the king of Syria, was a great man with his master and honorable, because by him Yahweh had given deliverance unto Syria, and he was also a mighty man in valor." And we'll stop there, at least at this point. Now, the preacher that morning pointed out the importance, began his message by pointing out the importance of Naaman, at least so far as the Syrians were concerned. He pointed out that he was basically the equivalent of the United States 4-star general, a renowned, and great man of great importance and prestige. In fact, look at the admirable qualities that are provided to us right there in the first verse of this particular chapter in this biblical description of Naaman. He's described as a great man and honorable. The New American Standard translates it that he was highly respected, and he was a mighty man of valor. And just as I read it, I didn't even pick up on this before, but it also says that it says he was honorable because by him Yahweh had given deliverance unto Syria. Now that's interesting. We're not talking about the Israel. We're talking about that God had given deliverance to Syria, that Yahweh had particularly used Naaman for Syria's sake. And of course, Yahweh being sovereign over all is indeed involved in all nations and in all that goes on in one fashion or another. And so, there's no question that by the very description that we find in God's Word here about Naaman, as we're first introduced to him, with all those descriptive phrases that Naaman indeed was a great and honorable man, a man that was highly respected, obviously both by Yahweh at least to some extent, and by the king and by his fellow countrymen as well. However, there was nevertheless something about Naaman that would eventually cause him to be isolated and separated from the king who loved him, and eventually even probably from the biggest majority of his fellow countrymen. Because what we didn't read in verse 5 about Naaman is that it says in the very end of that verse, it says, "But, in spite of all else that was good about him, by all the great and honorable things that was said about him," it then ends the description by saying, "But Naaman was a leper." And then continuing in verses 2 through 3, we find the following. It says, "And the Syrians had gone out by companies, and had brought away captive out of the land of Israel a little maid, and she waited on Naaman's wife. And I just picked up something else I hadn't thought about. In the verse previous, it says that Yahweh used Naaman to deliver Syria, and here they are out going against Israel. And so it may have very well been that he chose Naaman to deliver Syria because he wanted to judge Israel, because that's where Syria had gone out and attacked and brought this Israelite slave girl back from. Again, verse 2, it says, "And the Syrians were gone out by companies and had brought away captive out of the land of Israel a little maid, and she waited on Naaman's wife. And she said unto her mistress, Would God my Lord were with the prophet that is in Samaria," which is, of course, the capital of Israel, "for he would recover him," or heal him, "from his leprosy." Now, I want to take a little side track here, or rabbit trail, if you will, for just a moment, because I want to point out, don't ever think that you're too small, or you're too young, or you're too insignificant to be used by Yahweh. You know, Naaman owed his eventual healing as much to his wife's little slave girl as he did to later to the prophet, who actually told him what to do to be healed, did he not? And therefore also remember what we're told in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 26 and 28, where it says, "Consider your calling, brethren, that there were not many wise according to the flesh, not many not mighty, not many noble, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things which are strong, and the base things of the world and the despised, God has chosen the things that are not, that he might nullify the things that are." Again, found in 1 Corinthians 1, and you know that I often go there because I like that passage, because it describes Ted Weiland before Christ touched his life, and it describes all of you as well. God chose those type of people. But far too often we think, well, who am I that God would ever use me? Well, let me guarantee you, by the description we find in 1 Corinthians 1 and by the example of this little Israelite slave girl, you qualify. Don't ever think that you're too small, too young, or too insignificant for God to use you. He has called you. You're the very type of person that God can and will use if you only allow him to do so. Now, back to point and continuing with the story, verses 4 and 5. It says, "And one went in." This is after the little girl had gone to her mistress, her master, the master's wife, and said, "Oh, that Naaman had just, if he'd just go back to Samaria, or if he just lived in Samaria, he could go to the prophet and he'd heal him." What faith the little girl understood in the prophet, and therefore in God as well, in her God, not the God of the Syrians. And so, and then it says in verse 4, "And one went in and told his lord, saying, Thus and thus said the maid that is of the land of Israel. And the king of Syria said, Go, and I will send a letter unto the king of Israel. And he departed and took with him 10 talents of silver and 6,000 pieces of gold and 10 changes of raiment." Now, this further, what we find in that last verse, what the king chose to send as a gift with Naaman to the king in petition that Naaman might be healed on the advice of this one little girl. Can you imagine that? And here is this king of Syria saying, "Let's go try it out." You know, how many kings would do that? He must have loved, again, Naaman very deeply. And the amount that he sends with Naaman just further demonstrates how much this king loved Naaman. You think about the price that was paid. And by the way, think of the king in the sense of Yahweh and the price that he pays to heal those he loves. There's really, again, a type-anti-type thing going on here in the story of Naaman, even though we're talking about Syrians in this case and not Israelites. But it further demonstrates how great a man Naaman must have been, how important a man he must have been to his nation, and how much the king must have loved him. I didn't put a pencil to it, but let me assure you that 10 talents of silver, 6,000 pieces of gold, We're probably talking at least an ounce of gold there. Think about what 6,000 pieces of gold today would amount to, and maybe even more then. And 10 changes of clothes, let me assure you, is not chump change. We're talking about bucco bucks, is what we're talking about, that the king was willing to spend just to have Naaman come back healed. Let's continue, verses 6 and 7. Verse 6, and he brought the letter to the king of Israel, saying, "Now when this letter is come unto thee, behold, I have therefore sent Naaman my servant to thee, that thou mayest recover him of his leprosy." Verse 7, and it came to pass, when the king of Israel had read the letter, that he rent his clothes and said, He rent his clothes and said, "Am I God to kill and to make alive, that this man does send unto me to recover a man of his leprosy? Wherefore consider, I pray you, and see how he seeketh a quarrel against me." Now, put yourself in the king's place. I think you'll understand, you can kind of understand why the king would question the motives of the king of Syria in doing what he was doing. Israel had their share of lepers and other diseased people. And if the king could have cured lepers, he would have been out curing his own people of leprosy and the different diseases that they had. And so he's thinking to himself, he's thinking, this king of Assyria, he's just trying to incite a war with me and my nation. However, consider it also now from the king of Syria's perspective. Think about it. Diplomatic procedure or policy would have dictated that one king present his position, or his petition, I should say, to another king, rather than going around his authority to some civilian or peasant, even if it was a famous prophet. So the king of Syria has thought this out. He says, I'm not going to go over to this guy's land and go to his prophet. I better go to the king first. Now, fortunate for the king, Elisha got wind of what was going on. Pick it up with verse 8, and it says, "And it was so, when Elisha the man of God had heard that the king of Israel had rent his clothes, that he sent," and if you think about that, that's going to get around. That was a humbling thing. It was a thing of almost, it was almost a desperate measure, especially for a king to take his clothes and rent them. And so that's going to get around, and it says, "And it was so, when Elisha the man of God heard that the king of Israel had rent his clothes, that he sent to the king, saying, Wherefore hast thou rent thy clothes? Let him come now to me." You know, Elisha says, there's no reason for that, king. You know, you should have figured it out yourself. Send him to me. And it says, "And he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel." So Naaman came with his horses and with his chariot and stood at the door of the house of Elisha, probably better rendered the hut of Elisha. I'm sure Elisha was not a rich man and didn't have much, as most people probably didn't at that time. Verse 10, "And Elisha sent a messenger unto him, saying, Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and thy flesh shall come again to thee, and thou shalt be clean. But Naaman was wroth, and went away, and said, Behold, I thought he will surely come out to me, and stand, and call on the name of Yahweh his God, and strike his hand over the place, and recover the leper." And so, here he is, Naaman has gone to the king. And essentially, the king has rejected him, but says, "No, you know, don't worry about it, Naaman. Go to the prophet." And he gives him the address on the certain first or second street or Avenue B or Avenue A or whatever it was, and said, "Go down there to this certain hut that looks this certain way, and go talk to the prophet here." And of course, that's what he had been originally told by the slave girl, that it was the prophet. The prophet of Yahweh, who is the one indeed who could heal him. And so his anticipation, although it was squelched at first by going to the king, and the king rejects him, but now he's got more hope, and he's looking forward to what's ahead of him. He goes and he finds this humble little hut in the middle of Second Street in Samaria, and he's got this great entourage with him, and he's got these great expectations, and he becomes wroth, you know, with the answer of the man he's come to seek advice from. Now, you may think, well, that's a little odd, but put yourself in Naaman's place. Wouldn't you be just a little, let's be truthful, a whole lot put out and upset and angry as well? Human, prideful as you are, as we all tend to be. You know, here you come all of this distance, and we're probably talking about a 10 to 14 day journey on horseback with a large caravan to have carried all that gold. You know how much gold weighs and everything else. It would have been at least a fair-sized caravan of probably camels and who knows what else, and the food to be able to make the journey and so forth. So we're talking of a somewhat sizable caravan with wonderful gifts already turned down by the king of Israel. And so you're expecting some great man in probably beautiful attire and probably accompanied by his own entourage to favor you with his presence. Isn't that the way we would be thinking? And you can bet that is surely the way that old Naaman was thinking. You know, he goes to the king first. He's excited about that. You know, get to go into the presence of another king. That doesn't work. So he said, this has got to be somebody even better. It's the prophet of Israel. And lo and behold, you arrive at this prophet's humble hut. And the guy doesn't even bother to get up, come out of his house, and show himself. And instead sends his servant with a message to simply just go down to the Jordan and dunk yourself 7 times. That's it. That's all he got. You know, I've come all this way. Me, the 4-star general of Syria with all of these riches, and that's it? Now, can you see why Naaman just might have been a little upset? Can you maybe relate, having, you know, put yourself in his spot, that you might have been just a little upset as well? Let me tell you, you'd be mad as a hornet. And probably ready to start. The old king was worried about a war. Now he's got the old Elijah just sending out his servant, you know, saying, just go down to the river and dunk yourself 7 times. Now he's about got a war on his hands. Because this guy is the 4-star general, and he knows how to fight, and he is a man of valor, and he has been humiliated. And so he's probably about ready to start a war. And you can almost hear the contempt and the disdain and the abhorrence and the pride when he's thinking to himself, or even out loud before his servants, how dare you treat me in such a manner? Look at verse 12. In verse 12 he says, and are not the Abana and the Pharpar rivers of Damascus better than all the waters of Israel? May I not wash in them and be clean? So he turned and went away in a rage. Go wash in the stinking, muddy Jordan? You've got to be kidding. But thankfully, Naaman had some wise and some brave servants. And they're thinking to themselves, man, we've made this journey. We've come all this way to see the prophet and to hear what he has to say, and you're going to let your pride get in the way? Now, I guarantee you that's not quite how the servants put it to Naaman. But that is the gist of what they were obviously thinking. Look at verse 13. Verse 13, and his servants came near and spake unto him and said, my father, if the prophets had bid thee to do some great thing, wouldst thou not have done it? How much rather then when he saith to thee, wash and be clean? And he said, they're basically saying, Naaman, don't blow this opportunity. You know, you had enough faith to come to at least give this a try. Don't walk away just because he doesn't ask you to do some great thing. Don't walk away and lose what could be the opportunity of your lifetime, could be the very salvation of your life, or at least the extension thereof. Some wise servants. And so, if you know the story, you know that Naaman takes the advice. He was at least humble enough. He was probably so humbled anything would work at this point anyway. But he was humble enough to take the advice. However, I think, nevertheless, begrudgingly, Naaman trudges down, probably not at this point having a whole lot of faith in this situation, but being convinced by his servants, he trudges down to the Jordan, wades in until he's at least waist or chest deep, grabs his nose probably, and looking like an idiot, dumps himself. And as this particular preacher pointed out in telling the story, he said he came up and he probably put out his arms where he had the oozing sores, pus-filled sores on his arms. He looks at his arm and nope, nothing happened. Still the same. Still a leper. And at probably about that time, that servant who had come to him said, "Naaman, he didn't tell you to dunk once. He told you to dunk 7 times. And so Naaman grabs his nose again, and down he goes, and comes up, and once, or twice, thrice, 4 times, 5 times, 6 times, every time looking at his arms to see if any change has been made. And then finally, the 7th time, he dunks himself, verses 14 and 15, and it says, "And then went he down and dipped himself 7 times in the Jordan, according to the saying of the man of God, and his flesh came again like unto the flesh of a little child, and he was clean." And know too that he wasn't just cleansed of his leprosy. How often it is that when we ask something of God, he blesses us, not always, because he knows what's best always for our lives, but how often it is that when he does hear our request, when he fulfills our request, that he goes even on beyond the request as well. It makes me think of 1 John 1 and verse 9, when we've sinned and we've known it, we've repented and we know we've got to get ourselves right with God. It says, "If we confess our sins, he is faithful and just to forgive us of our sins and cleanse us from all unrighteousness." And he says, if he looks at the attitude of the heart and he says, if you're willing to confess what you know to be sin, I'll not only forgive you of that, I'll forgive you of all the other sins I know about that you haven't figured out yet. How often true it is. And so he not only came up cleansed of a leper, he took his skin as probably at least a 25-year-old man up to maybe a 40-year-old man and took his skin and changed it into that of a baby's skin. You know, the softest of all skin that there is. And then it says, and he returned. He comes up and he's clean. And he returned to the man of God, he and all of his company, and came and stood before him and said, "Behold, now I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. Now therefore I pray thee, take a blessing of thy servant." Interesting too that until now, probably Naaman had no idea of what's stated in verse 1, that it was Yahweh who had made him successful and used him to deliver Syria. But now he knows. Not only knows that God, Yahweh, is a great God, but he goes beyond that and he says, "Now I know that there is no God in all the earth except Yahweh." And think about that. Anything less than that would have been unacceptable. To have just elevated God to the level of all their gods, of the gods of Syria, would have meant nothing to God, and certainly would not be a testimony to anyone of anything. Or to even raise Yahweh to a better God than all the gods. That doesn't work either. We're still talking pluralism. We're still talking, instead of monotheism, mono versus poly. Instead of talking monotheism, we're talking polytheism, even if he raised him up to be the greatest of all gods. Naaman understood, finally understood. Naaman, the Syrian, who came to obviously, by this statement, would prove that this non-Israelite could join himself to Yahweh, because he recognized him as the only God in all the earth, the God of Israel. Now, the primary point, that was the story, and I may have told it a lot like he told it, as many other preachers have in the past, and probably I have in the past, and maybe a little bit different in certain areas, and with a little different flair than the flair that he may have used, but that was essentially the message that we heard preached. And from that story, the primary point the preacher that morning was making, and the question that this preacher today wants to pose to you is, do you think that Naaman would have been cleansed of his leprosy if he had trooped on home and dunked himself in either the Abana or Pharpar rivers of Syria? What do you think? No. Okay, good. You're all doing your heads the right way. You're either noncommittal or at least you're going the right way with them. Okay. I think we all agree. It wouldn't have worked. Well, what if he had followed instructions and dunked himself 7 times in the Abana and Pharpar? What do you think? Still wouldn't have worked, would it? Okay, what if he had dunked himself in the Jordan? Once. Twice. I'm still getting those heads going in the right direction. That's good. Thrice. 4 times, 5 times, 6 times. What do you think? No, I don't think so either. Why not? Because those weren't the instructions. Or at the best, Naaman would have obeyed only some of the instructions and not all of them. The preacher that morning rightly emphasized the point that we must follow the instructions. And not just some of the instructions, but all of the instructions. Anybody disagree with that? Well, praise Yahweh, Naaman finally did just that. In other words, Naaman didn't fall short in following Elisha's divine instructions, and nor did he, as a result, come short in the resulting promise found therein. That takes us back to Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 1, where it says, "Fear lest ye fall short of the promise of the gospel." What an example there is in that story. And what an exhortation for us that we have got to do. We're no different than Naaman. And if we don't follow instructions, we fall short. And he was therein, because he followed instructions, was healed by Yahweh, and thus, think about this, and thus Yahweh received all the praise and glory. And that in itself may be the primary reason why we must follow the instructions to the T. Because if we can arrive at the same results by our own doing, or even by partially doing it Yahweh's way and partially doing it our ways, then we make ourselves equal with Yahweh, do we not? And He won't receive all. He cannot receive all the praise and glory. And we then deserve as much praise and glory as He does. And so I don't know. The Bible doesn't tell me that's the reason we must follow instructions to the T, but as I thought about it, I thought, you know, I'm not so sure that's not the primary reason. Not just for our sakes, but so that our God receives all the praise and glory. You know, 1 Corinthians 1, it makes me think of that right now, just off the cuff here, that I referred to a little bit earlier, where it says, none of you were mighty, none of you were great men and women, none of you were the simple, you were not the wise. That's not the people He normally chooses. And then he says that at the end of that chapter, he says that no man may glory before God. In other words, so that God gets all the glory. So I'm not so sure that's not the primary reason. Now, the story of Naaman is but one biblical story that illustrates the point. And that is that we must follow the instructions, all of the instructions. Take Nadab and Abihu, for example. Nadab and Abihu were the sons of Aaron, and therefore they had the inside track, if you will, to the Aaronic priesthood. In other words, they were born, in a sense, with a silver spoon in their mouth. You might say that it was salvation by race, if you will, or at least genetic or ancestral privileges for any son born in the Aaronic line. If you were born of Aaron's lineage, you were automatically of priestly, possibly even high priest stock, and therefore you had it made, right? That is, so long, and that is true, so long as you followed instructions. Look at Numbers. Turn with me to the book of Numbers, and let's read about Nadab and Abihu. There's not much about them, but what is to be found is found here and in another passage that says the same thing in, I believe, the book of Leviticus. Numbers chapter 3, and we'll start with verse 1 again. Numbers chapter 3, and it says, "These are also the generations of Aaron and Moses in the day that Yahweh spake with Moses in Mount Sinai. And these are the names of the sons of Aaron, Nadab the firstborn, and Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. These are the names of the sons of Aaron, the priest, which were anointed, whom he consecrated to minister in the priest office." Verse 4. "And Nadab and Abihu died before Yahweh when they offered strange fire before Yahweh in the wilderness of Sinai, and they had no children. And Eleazar and Ithamar ministered in the priest office in the sight of Aaron, their father." Now that's all. That's it. That's all that we know about Nadab and Abihu. That is their legacy. And some kind soul might think, in reading that, they might think, well, their judgment, that seems awfully harsh. You know, after all, it wasn't as if they refused the priestly office or that they even refused to offer fire at all. They just didn't offer exactly the type of fire that Yahweh prescribed. And so they're thinking, man, that seems harsh. Well, listen to me. The lesson of Nadab and Abihu, as little as there is that's said about them, is even more powerful than his name. These two men weren't Syrians. They were Israelites. And not only Israelites, but they were even of the more privileged priestly lineage of Aaron, brother of Moses. And yet they fell short of the promise because they didn't follow instructions. And because they made substitutions for what Yahweh had prescribed. Now listen to me, and please get this into your heads. And I'm not talking, I mean, I may be going to apply this to one particular area, but we need to apply it wherever it is when it comes to the instruction manual and whatever God reveals for us to understand. But get this in your head. Yahweh does not accept substitutions and incomplete obedience. He does not. Turn with me to 1 Samuel 15, and I think we can see it again. Beginning with verse 1 again. I'm just going to go ahead and read it as you're turning there. It says, "And Samuel also said," 1 Samuel 15:1, "Samuel also said unto Saul, Yahweh sent me to anoint thee to be king over his people, over Israel. Now therefore hearken thou unto the voice of the words of Yahweh." And so, Samuel begins this, at least this chapter begins by Samuel, I'm sure Samuel had done it before, but reminding Saul. He says, "Saul, it wasn't you, but it was Yahweh who chose you, and therefore you are to follow his instructions. Thou now therefore hearken unto the voice of the words of Yahweh. Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, I remember that which Amalek did to Israel, how he laid wait for him in the way when he came up from Egypt. Now go and smite Amalek, and utterly destroy all that they have, and spare them not, but slay both man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass. And Saul gathered the people together, and numbered them in Telaim, 200,000 footmen and 10,000 men of Judah. And Saul came to a city of Amalek, and laid waste in the valley." Jump down to verse 7. "And Saul smote the Amalekites from Havilah until Thou comest to Shur, that is over against Egypt. And he took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive, and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag, and the best of the sheep and of the oxen, and of the fatlings and of the lambs, and all that was good, and would not utterly destroy them, but everything that was vile and refuse, that they destroyed utterly. Now I want you to note the instructions to begin with, and how, it's instructions from Samuel, and how Saul followed those instructions. Yahweh instructed Samuel to instruct Saul to utterly destroy, that was the, at least in the English, that's the term that was used, to utterly destroy the Amalekites and all of their possessions. And that's precisely what we are told that Saul and his army did. In verses 8 and 9, we find the exact same words used, whether in the Hebrew or in the English. Verse 8 informs us that they utterly destroyed all the people. And in verse 9 informs us that they utterly destroyed all that was vile and refuse. Ah, the human mind is an amazing thing, isn't it? It is indeed an amazing thing. Especially how it can justify and rationalize just about anything. We will take instructions from Yahweh. Now, let's not just point the old finger at Saul here, because we all have this tendency, this ability. We can take instructions from Yahweh, sometimes using His very words, and twist and turn them and manipulate them and finesse them so that they mean what we want them to mean, so we can do what we want to do instead of what Yahweh actually had instructed us to do. Isn't that what Saul did? And isn't that what we're all capable of doing as well? And it provides you, that isn't certainly, indeed, what Saul did. And to provide you with a modern example, isn't that what people do today when, for example, they take the Greek word baptizo, which clearly, unequivocally, unquestionably, unarguably means to immerse. And they take it and they manipulate that and they finesse it and they twist and they turn it and even use the word itself, or at least the English transliteration of the word, and then declare that they have been baptized when in fact they have offered to Yahweh a strange water, a strange baptism, as strange as was the fire of Nadab and Abihu. Isn't that what they do? Now, some people may argue, I mean, it's unarguable. I mean, all you have to do is go to all the Greek lexicons, and look at the context of passages, and look what's said, and it means immerse. Now, some people will still argue that, but that's unarguable. But I have heard people admit that it means to immerse. In fact, I preached a series not all that long ago concerning some who do this beyond absolutely, that admit that God chose that word, baptizo, which means to immerse, but He didn't really mean that. I don't know if I pointed it out in that series or not, but have you ever known God to ever use a word that everybody understood to mean one thing? I think I did point this out, but He really meant it to mean something totally, totally different than what it was. And oh, they finessed and they manipulated because they wanted to prove what they wanted to prove instead of just accepting whether they could understand it or put all the scriptures together that and how they worked and fit together or not, they, instead of accepting what God said to do. I mean, that just proves the point that we're not all that different today in this generation than was old King Saul. Calling immersion sprinkling or pouring, or sprinkling or pouring baptism. Listen to me, Saul didn't get away with such tactics. Back to 1 Samuel 15, picking it up with verse 10 and reading on. Verse 10 it says, "And then came the word of Yahweh unto Samuel, saying, It repenteth me that I have set up Saul to be king, for he has turned back from following me, and has not performed my commandments. And it grieved Samuel, and he cried unto Yahweh all night. And when Samuel rose early to meet Saul in the morning, it was told Samuel, saying, Saul, come to Carmel. And behold, he set him up a place, and is gone about, and passed on, and gone down to Gilgal. And Samuel came to Saul, and Saul said to him, Blessed be thou of Yahweh, I have performed the commandment of Yahweh. You know, he had convinced himself that he had done exactly what was required of him. And oh, how we are able to do that as well. And Samuel said, What meaneth then this bleating of the sheep in mine ears and the lowing of the oxen which I hear? And Saul said, They have brought them forth from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen. I'm sure he's just bristling up with pride that he'd done so well. You know, they brought the best of the sheep and the oxen to sacrifice unto Yahweh thy God, and the rest we have utterly destroyed. Then Samuel said unto Saul, Stay, and I will tell thee. You know, maybe it wasn't that Saul had convinced himself, and maybe instead Saul knew exactly what he had done, and he was just trying to get away with it. And so you can imagine, when somebody's telling you a lie and they know it, you know, they hardly look into your eye, or they get done telling it and they just want to move on. You know, they walk on. And so here in verse 16 it says, And then Samuel said unto Saul, Stay, and I will tell thee what Yahweh has said to me this night. And he said to him, Say on. And Samuel said, When thou wast little in thine own sight, was thou not made the head of the tribes of Israel? And Yahweh anointed thee king over Israel. And Yahweh sent thee on a journey and said, Go and utterly destroy the sinners of the Amalekites, and fight against them until they be consumed. Wherefore then didst thou not obey the voice of Yahweh, and didst fly upon the spoil, and didst evil in the sight of Yahweh? Well, he's been caught in his sin. Let me tell you, Saul wasn't a David. When Nathan came to David and pointed out, Thou art the man, there was no him-hawing around and trying to get around the situation. David just repented. He had a heart after God. But not yet for Saul. And Saul said unto Samuel, Yea, I have obeyed the voice of Yahweh, and have gone the way which Yahweh sent me, and have brought Agag, the king of the Amalekites, the king of Amalek, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. He just got done saying, I didn't kill the king, the one that probably was needed to kill the most, but I utterly destroyed them, using the same words again. But the people took the spoil. And oh, here's this old tactic, the old blame tactic, blame somebody else. Aaron did it earlier. Eve did it. Adam did it. Blame somebody else. But the people took the spoil, sheep and oxen, the chief of the things which should have been utterly destroyed, to sacrifice unto Yahweh thy God in Gilgal. And Samuel said, Hath Yahweh as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of Yahweh? How many churches there are who are willing to sacrifice for God, and yet they're doing it their own way. And God says, Oh, I love your sacrifice. That is, so long as you do it as I have prescribed. And Samuel said, Has Yahweh as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of Yahweh? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams. For rebellion is the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Because thou hast rejected the word of Yahweh, he has also rejected thee from being king. Look at, even when rebellion is attached to sacrifice unto Yahweh, God considers it the same as iniquity and idolatry and witchcraft. Listen to me, Saul didn't get away with the tactics that he tried to use, and neither will we. We are, let me guarantee, we are no more special in any sense of the word than is Saul, or was Saul. And we also won't get away with, by the way, we also won't get away with it when some man of God or some preacher comes along and instructs us otherwise. Well, I wouldn't have believed the substitute instructions if my preacher hadn't come along and told me that's the way it was, or told me that's how I was to interpret the instructions. Now, it's true that Yahweh has called, does call, and sends preachers. But that does not alleviate or relieve you of your own responsibility to study the Word of God to show yourselves approved unto God, does it? Absolutely not. And the story of the unnamed prophet probably illustrates this better than anything else in the entire Bible. Turn with me to 1 Kings 13. And beginning with verse 1. Again, a little bit of length. This is a lengthy passage again to read to you, but one that certainly has a lot and much more than I'll be sharing in this message to share with us. So it's worth the reading. Chapter 1 Kings chapter 13 verse 1, it says, "And behold, there came a man of God out of Judah by the word of Yahweh unto Bethel, and Jeroboam stood by the altar to burn incense. And he cried against the altar in the word of Yahweh and said, O altar, altar, thus saith Yahweh, behold, a child shall be born into the house of David, Josiah by name, and upon thee shall he offer the priests of the high places that burn incense upon thee, and men's bones shall be burnt upon thee. And he gave a sign the same day, saying, This is the sign which Yahweh has spoken. Behold, the altar shall be rent, and the ashes that are upon it shall be poured out. And it came to pass when..." Now, by the way, I didn't look to see exactly where the passage is, but that came true to the T. This was a prophet of God called by Yahweh to bring that very message. Josiah was born, and he did exactly as it had been prophesied. Verse 4, "And it came to pass, when King Jeroboam heard the saying of the man of God, which had cried against the altar in Bethel, that he put forth his hand from the altar, saying, Lay hold on him. And his hand which he put forth against him dried up, so that he could not pull it in again to him. And the altar was also rent, and the ashes poured out from the altar, according to the sign which the man of God had given by the word of Yahweh. And the king answered and said unto the man of God, Entreat now the face of Yahweh thy God, and pray for me, that my hand may be restored me again. And the man of God besought Yahweh, and the king's hand was restored him again, and became as it was before." Lesson there. Boy, if you know that some man is an anointed of God, be careful that you don't lay a hand on him. Now, there's some guys that may claim to be anointed, and they need your hands laid on them. But if he's an anointed of Yahweh, and you're convinced of it, you just better be careful. God doesn't allow it. Verse 7, "And the king said unto the man of God, Come home with me." Now the old king says, hey, come. He's gonna want to entertain this prophet. You know, he's now seen the power of God, and instead of wanting to lay his hands and kill the guy, he now wants to entertain him. "And the king said unto the man of God, Come home with me and refresh thyself, and I will give thee a reward. And the man of God said unto the king, If thou wilt give me half thine house, I will not go in with thee, neither will I eat bread nor drink water in this place. For so it was charged me by the word of Yahweh, saying, Eat no bread, nor drink water, nor turn again by the same way that thou camest. So he went another way and returned by the way that he came to Bethel. And you think the story probably ends there? It doesn't. Continuing, verse 11, "Now there dwelt an old prophet in Bethel, and his sons came and told him that all the works that the man of God had done that day in Bethel, the words which he had spoken unto the king, that they told also to their father. And their father said unto them, What way went he? For his sons had seen what way the man of God went, which came from Judah. And he said unto his sons, Saddle me the ass. So they saddled him the ass, and he rode thereon. And went after the man of God, and found him sitting under the oak. And he said unto him, Art thou the man of God that camest from Judah? And he said, I am. And then he said unto him, Come home with me, and eat bread. And he said, I may not return with thee, nor go with thee, neither will I eat bread, nor drink water with thee in this place. Same thing he tells the prophet, this old prophet, the same thing he told the king. Verse 17, For it was said to me by the word of Yahweh, Thou shalt eat no bread, nor drink water there, nor turn again to go by the way that thou camest. And then it says in verse 18, And he said to them, I am a prophet also, as thou art. And an angel spoke unto me by the word of Yahweh, saying, Bring him back with thee unto thy house, that he may eat bread and drink water. But he lied to him. And so he went back, this unnamed earlier younger prophet, and so he went back with him, and he did eat bread in his house and drank water. And it came to pass, as they sat at the table, that the word of Yahweh came unto the prophet that brought him back. And he cried unto the man of God that came from Judah, saying, Thus saith Yahweh, Forasmuch as thou hast disobeyed the mouth of Yahweh, and hast not kept the commandment which Yahweh thy God commanded thee, but camest back and hast eaten bread and drunk water in the place of which the Lord did say unto thee, Eat no bread and drink no water, thy carcass shall not come into the sepulchre of thy fathers. And it came to pass, after he had eaten bread and after he had drunk, that he saddled for him the ass, to wit, for the prophet whom he had brought back. And when he was gone, a lion met him by the way and slew him, and his carcass was cast in the way, and the ass stood by it, and the lion also stood by the carcass. How truly tragic. This unnamed prophet, this story is all we know about him. This unnamed prophet couldn't be bought off by the king and all his riches, however he was taken in and done in by a false prophet. But it was the false prophet who deceived him. No. It was the unnamed prophet who allowed himself to be deceived by the false prophet. He had his inspired instructions straight from God, just like we do. And he chose instead to follow the instructions of a local preacher instead. And keep in mind, only the blind will allow the blind to lead them into a ditch. So open your eyes. And don't just listen to the local preacher, including this one. Study to show yourselves approved unto God. And don't forget, one day, because one day we must all stand before the throne of God alone and give account for ourselves and our actions. There will be no preacher, or anyone else for that matter, standing next to us to blame our shortcomings on. That tactic didn't work for Adam and Eve, and it won't work for us either. You can say all day long, but my preacher said, and it still will not matter. This preacher chose to believe another preacher, and it didn't work for him, meaning the unnamed prophet. Hopefully, you will be standing there with Yeshua, covered in his blood. But that will only be possible if you have followed the instructions. Let's look at one more biblical example. I think I've got time to do this. Of someone else who fell short initially, but who praised Yahweh when he was faced with the fact that he hadn't followed the instructions, or followed all, or more precisely, all of the instructions, followed through with what was yet required of him. Turn to Acts chapter 18. And again, I'm a little bit short on time, so I'll read it as I get there. Acts chapter 18, and beginning with verse 24, it says, "And a certain Jew or Judahite named Apollos, born at Alexandria, an eloquent man and mighty in the Scriptures, came to Ephesus. This man was instructed in the way of the Lord, and being fervent in spirit, he spake and taught diligently the things of the Lord, knowing only the baptism of John. And he began to speak boldly in the synagogue, whom when Aquila and Priscilla had heard him, they took him unto them and expounded unto him the way of God more perfectly." Now, obviously, there was something that Aquila and Priscilla recognized as lacking in what he was doing, and so they take him aside and explain him the way of God more accurately. Now, this is where we're first introduced to the man called Barnabas, who later became a traveling companion of the Apostle Paul. And although there are certainly differences, Barnabas reminds me a lot of Naaman. Whereas Naaman was a physical warrior, Barnabas was a spiritual warrior. And like Naaman, there were admirable qualities about Barnabas as well. Verses 24-5 again tell us that Barnabas was an eloquent man and mighty in the Scriptures, that he was instructed in the way of the Lord, was fervent in spirit, and that he taught diligently the things concerning the things of Yahweh. However, like Naaman fell short, if you will, in the physical, in that he was a leper, Barnabas likewise fell short in the spiritual. And the proof of that is found not only in verse 26, but in the latter part of verse 25. That is, in that he was, it says all of these different great things, these admirable things about Barnabas. And yet at the very end, the last thing it says was that he was, but being only acquainted with the baptism or the immersion of John. And so out of all of these other things, there's something there that's not quite right. In other words, and that obviously must have been what it was that Aquila and Priscilla recognized in him. In other words, just like Barnabas' disciples, At least we're fairly certain they were probably Barnabas' disciples there in Ephesus, being that he was probably the leading man when he was there. But in other words, just like Barnabas' disciples that Paul later encountered after Barnabas leaves in Ephesus in Acts 19, 1 through 5, which is the follow-up of what we just read, Barnabas hadn't been, but needed to be, immersed in Yeshua's immersion for the remission of his sins, which is precisely what Barnabas must have done. Because we find the following in verses 26, again verse 26 and following. And he began to speak boldly in the synagogue, whom when Aquila and Priscilla had heard, they took him unto them and expounded unto him the way of God more perfectly or accurately. And when he was disposed to pass unto Achaia, the brethren wrote, exhorting the disciples to receive him, who when he was come, helped them much which had believed through grace. And so Priscilla and Aquila now, after having expounded to them, and obviously after Barnabas having followed through with what was necessary, which is certainly probably described in the next verses in chapter 19 with those other 12 men that were his disciples, he was immersed, and they then sent letters and said letters of commendation, sending him on and saying, accept him, he's preaching now as he should be preaching, and has followed through with what needed to be done. Now, Barnabas initially fell short. Initially fell short, just as did Naaman. But praise Yahweh, Barnabas too went down to the Jordan, or some other river or pool of water, since it wasn't designated to have been, immersion didn't have to always be under the new covenant in the Jordan, and was not seven times, but was dipped once, as was only required in the instructions, for the remission of his sins, that he might receive the indwelling of the Holy Spirit. Acts chapter 2 and verse 38 and Acts 22 and 16 is proof that that's what Christ's baptism was for. Now, I assure you, I have known them, that there have been and are today many like Barnabas. People who are eloquent, mighty in the Scriptures, instructed in the way of the Lord, fervent in spirit, teaching diligently the things of Yahweh. And usually that's the criteria. Most people would look out there and say, oh, there's one of those people. There's a Barnabas. Man, we need to follow and go wherever he leads. Let me tell you, there are many people like Barnabas today who can have all of those same qualities, who, like Barnabas, fall short of following the instructions. And therefore also fall short of the promise of the gospel, who only know not even the immersion of John, but only know the baptism or the immersion of man, either substituting sprinkling or pouring for immersion, or substituting the man-made plan of salvation by accepting Jesus into your heart for the biblical plan of salvation is found in Mark 16, 16, Acts 2, 38 through 42, Acts 22, 1 through 16, Romans 6, 3 through 4, Galatians 3, 26 through 27, Colossians 2, 11 and 12, and 1 Peter 3, 21. And they don't need any explanation because they say what they say, and anybody can read them for what they say. In other words, metaphorically speaking, people who want to go to the Abana and the Pharpar rivers instead of to the Jordan. What inspired this message was that after preaching a wonderful message, a better message on Naaman than I did. In fact, I borrowed most of it from him. After preaching a wonderful message on Naaman and the absolute necessity of not only following instructions, but following all the instructions, the preacher that morning failed to follow his own admonition and failed to provide his audience all the instructions as found in the previous cited scriptures. And thus, regrettably, falls short himself of the promise. And so will those in his audience who do not study to show themselves approved and follow his same instructions as well.